use and exploration of tariffs and tariff policy. Because it's moving so quickly, it has a disruptive effect, very similar to the early stages of the pandemic. Even a 1 year delay in their planning has a massive ripple effect on hundreds, if not thousands, of other investments. This is not an incremental market movement. We're seeing industries completely rethink what they're actually going to produce by product line, maybe for months, if not permanently.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lanfear, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Richard Barnett. Richard is Chief Marketing Officer at SupplyFrame, the leading platform for global electronic supply chain solutions. He's at the helm of strategy for SupplyFrame, and he can translate some of the market volatility into competitive advantage. He's a frequent speaker on global trade, reshoring, and digital transformation. If you're interested in better understanding the current tariff crisis and how global trade patterns may shape the real estate industry, this podcast is well worth a listen. Richard, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today.
Great to be with you, Gordon.
So, can you tell us a little bit about what got you into supply chains and the transportation industry in general?
Yeah, no, I started my career early on in supply chain management and optimization in the late 90s. And that was an interesting time to start looking at the early adoption of global supply chain planning and optimization solutions, particularly for multinationals that have very complex supply chain networks. And we're facing increasing competition. And a lot of that competitive value add was in speed, agility, and managing their inventory very efficiently and matching demand opportunities more quickly and really rebalancing kind of capacity, maybe across global networks, because that was the early wave of globalization. And so that turned into a long career working with leading companies, driving innovation, helping them think through what's next. In different industries, whether it's kind of high tech, automotive, industrial, kind of core manufacturing, but also in consumer goods and retail to a great degree.
So the wave of globalization is at a very different point than it was in the 1990s. How have those tensions in the fight between globalization, regionalization, and nationalization kind of played out, from your perspective?
Well, I mean, I think there's multiple factors that have generally shifted us away from kind of a general focus on globalization to drive cost and efficiency in global supply chains. So, there really was a focus on chase and develop, relationships with suppliers and the maybe the lowest cost to manufacture. And also, balance your supply networks and your distribution networks to best meet and be flexible to meet, regional demand centers like in Europe, Americas, et cetera, and in Asia Pacific. What came with that was the growth of, a lot of innovation around logistics networks and third-party logistics providers to provide a lot of flexibility and visibility to those global supply chains, but also there's been a real shift around it being for lowest cost and more around highest quality and where there is sort of clusters of innovation and capability, depending on what key markets or industries you're looking at. So we saw that in automotive over a much longer period of time because that's one of the longest sort of industry evolutions we've seen that goes back over 100 years, where you saw highly integrated regional supply chains, across multiple tiers of suppliers. In electronics, what you found, particularly say in China initially, was the ability to, build ecosystems around specialized electronics in products and the ability to scale and ramp up very quickly. So it wasn't just about lowest cost, it was about flexibility, the ability to ramp to volume, and then have all the expertise of nearby, multiple, suppliers and service providers around where those kind of industry innovation centers were. We see that differently in like, industries that are still focused on very low cost, footwear and apparel, for example, is one of those areas where it sort of stayed in that early zone of, it's highly concentrated in Bangladesh and Vietnam and other kind of locus manual intensive production processes, generally speaking. But where the innovation has occurred there is around, you know, fabrics and, you know, materials that go into the final cut and sew operation. So, you know, across these different industries, we've seen specialization becoming more regional, the value add being not just about lowest cost, but really around kind of innovation, expertise, know-how. And then where it's been capital intensive, you've seen a lot of focus around automation and skill sets around machine tooling and the ability to automate with new forms of robotics and industrial automation, that where there's a heavy amount of investment that's gone into capital intensive investments. And so the globalization has shifted to more regionalization naturally over time as you try to balance where those investment and those capability centers are. And that's why I think when we look at the current state of reviewing tariffs and what the tariff goals can be, and geopolitical pressures where we have kind of a realignment of, you know, major kind of power bases and sort of spheres of influence, those are pushing back on sort of early globalization, but the context of where investments are made and the scale of the global supply chains and how integrated they are, it's shifted, but it's actually probably more globalized and interconnected today than it was back in the late 90s, even though we're seeing a pressure to move back to regionalization. So it's a bit of a layered, you know, kind of observation over time.
Yeah. In terms of layered observations and kind of understanding how time has affected things, one of the biggest issues that we consistently talk to either occupiers in some of our industrial buildings or some of our tenants that we work with in our tenant brokerage practice is they are very concerned in the post-2020 world with some of the shocks that occurred to supply chains. And where do you see those risks most playing out in the current trade structure? And how are you kind of seeing that play out with some of your clients
Well, I mean, in a weird way, the global pandemic was a, you know, unprecedented global shock to every supply chain, every market, right? And it tested the fragility of kind of global supply chains in different ways, right? You know, sort of, we all saw the rush to buy toilet paper and kind of panic buying and the kind of consumer products. That was where we had like peak supply chain awareness of everybody, you know, and that wasn't necessarily a bad thing in my view. I think we, as consumers, as, you know, no matter what our field is of, you know, professional fields, we should be more aware, right, of how interconnected and dependent we are in certain, in this sort of supply chain that, you know, connects to us, right, you know, in those ways. We also saw very specifically how certain industries were hardwired for efficiency and were massively challenged. So automotive was the one where we saw, you know, supply frame, the sort of global electronics market, we could see what was happening far upstream to automotive. And when these big constraints, particularly around key electronic components, those shortages started moving slowly through the system, it surprised global OEMs that are viewed as best in class, like Toyota, for example, and BMW, Volkswagen, the best, you know, global OEMs, generally they're viewed as sort of managing their inbound supply chain really well, had factory shutdowns. We're being surprised, you know, with 2-week lead time notice of what was happening, even though you could see it unfold if you had the right market intelligence information over 6 months. And the reason for that is they had leaned out their global supply chain so much that, you know, they were just in time, just in sequence, right? They optimized the flow of inbound materials to be just enough to meet that, you know, few days of production line demand for final assembly. And then they put huge amount of cost and liability pressure on their tier one suppliers and the tier two suppliers. So there was no incentive when that shift happened in demand and the automotive OEM said, we're not sure how many cars or trucks we're going to be selling. Let's pause. There was no incentive to hold strategic inventory buffers at the tier one, tier two, or anywhere upstream. And so what happened was the other really interesting insight is a lot of those electronics and components that are used in car manufacturing are common components that are used in other devices and other end applications. So that demand and that available supply immediately just pivoted and was consumed by those areas that were, you know, expanding very quickly. All of the kind of data center mobile services, because everyone was working from home, learning from home, laptops were hot commodity when they were really boring, you know, there was like 1% incremental growth year over year, suddenly became a spike item. And so what that revealed was how interdependent sort of in key supply chains, particularly electronics, are across multiple industries, because we've sort of electrified, you know, these different industries, and you're almost competing industry to industry versus, you know, just sort of just your tier one supplier managing that inbound supply risk or source of supply. The problem, if we fast forward to now, is many global manufacturers didn't, I think, learn the lesson learned in the pandemic, because there was so much firefighting that was going on to just survive and get through it, that where we landed was, you know, some incremental changes, greater visibility, greater focus on maybe some critical supplier long-term agreements. But generally speaking, not getting to the root cause of how to, you know, design in more resilience, more flexibility in the product design, because every new product is a new supply chain basically being designed and built in, but also in terms of their supply chain network. Now, fast forward to where we are right now, also an incredibly unprecedented time, but not an externality. Like, this is specifically being led by the current administration's aggressive, you know, use and exploration of tariffs and tariff policy, and then the response of our key trading partners. But because it's moving so quickly, it has a disruptive effect, very similar to the early stages of the pandemic, where we're seeing tons of forward inventory buying, inbound shipments to try to, you know, beat the tariff impact exposure. And that has been a very artificial, outside of any normal demand or supply consumption pattern. So the problem is we're highly constrained again. And any incremental issue around cost increases, trying to buy time to shift sources of supply, are clearly going to lead to both market imbalances, where you have long lead times and you have the maybe too much of the wrong stuff, or, you know, you're going to have to delay production schedules, new product launches, et cetera. We're seeing all that already happen, even with the current uncertainty that's in the market. So the key is, like, this drive to reshoring into more flexible, localized operations and holding inventory buffers. I mean, some of that has consistently moved forward in key supply chains because of the pandemic, particularly in North America. But again, the scale and effect and the potential long-term to medium-term impacts of the tariff changes that are either in effect or proposed and actively being negotiated far exceeds that general improvement that we've built into our flexibility in our supply chains.
I know you mentioned kind of briefly some of them, but where do you see the biggest risks are associated with some of the supply chain shock that has been created by the tariffs? Because I know that certainly we are talking to occupiers on both the tenant and landlord side, and they're all worried about various sections of the market. But where do you see, for the overall market as a whole, some of the biggest risks that landlords or tenants should be watching out for?
Well, I do think that there is a sector-specific set of risks and timing considerations. So if you look at, for example, fast-moving consumer goods, anything related to, you know, warehouse, logistics, distribution centers, there's both global retailers, e-commerce, fulfillment marketplaces are going to rebalance fairly dynamically, either in terms of, you know, aligning inventory and shipments to cost and then absorbing or sensing when there's a demand shift, right? In terms of, you know, consumer behavior, et cetera. That's an easier zone to both see the immediate impact, but also it's much more dynamic and flexible to kind of readjust to new cost levels and to kind of consumer demand and the rebalance inventories or shipments. But that's the first wave of impact. The uncertainty is what's kind of the biggest risk in the near term, but that is probably going to, within 3 to 6 months timeframe, is when you're going to have enough visibility to what the impact of the changes are to start dynamically trying to rebalance. Where we have the biggest concentration of risk in inbound products from primarily China, but related, you know, Southeast Asian markets that are, you know, particularly in apparel and footwear, and we've seen the markets kind of react to Nike and other global brands, you know, very, very carefully, depending on where the tariff impacts is. That might be a little bit more structural in terms of its impact. It might, you know, slow down, you know, new product launches. There may be a strategic, you know, repositioning of inventory of product lines or assortment planning, because of the higher costs and uncertainty around how to absorb that. It's in the discrete manufacturing side that we're going to see, I think, more structural changes, but it'll be more visible, you know, in a 3 to 9 month, you know, view because of the nature of kind of the mix of, you know, sort of and complexity of sources of supply and the way to absorb those costs. So anything in industrial automation, automotive, you know, even like lower volume, higher mix, aerospace and defense might be a little bit buffered and protected in the short term, but they're facing, you know, also supply chain risks in these areas. Any of these large discrete manufacturing, we have kind of final assembly locations in capital intensive investments, the switching cost to try to realign or sort of optimize the cost of manufacturing and supply, you know, is anywhere between, you know, 2 to 3 years for, you know, final assembly that, you know, kind of either be, you know, ramped up fairly quickly, or, you know, you can work with different manufacturing partners like EMSs to help, you know, sort of sustain a shift fairly quickly. But the, like the new semiconductor fabs, et cetera, they're already underway. That, you know, that's a 5 to 6 year, you know, significant multi-billion dollar, you know, capital outlay and investment. So you're going to see that kind of in, you know, the indicators of where there's risk, both in terms of, you know, where there's structural changes, like we're going to, you know, ramp up new manufacturing very quickly, or we're going to, you know, ramp down manufacturing site because it no longer makes sense to build products or final assemble products there. That can be very binary in terms of outcomes. But you also will see a need for greater certainty to continue forward in the maybe the planned capital outlay investments for things that take a, you know, 3 to 6 year build out on the schedule. And so we've seen kind of, if you look at those major capital investment projects, they're highly visible, you know, in electronic, you know, in semiconductor, for example, you know, key states are, you know, Texas and Utah and Arizona, et cetera. And, but even those planned commitments are all of it's getting relooked because the cost of capital might be changing. And it's very important to look at the ecosystem that has to be built up both from logistics, you know, transportation, and then tier one suppliers that co-locate into those new hubs. All of that, you know, add on, you know, sort of investment, is going to be, and the timing for that is going to be, you know, looked at with fresh eyes across the board because the decision calculus, the investment calculus is now shifted dramatically. So those are ones I think you can get ahead of it, but you've got to look at it very carefully and understand the sort of ecosystem impact around the timing and the sort of speed of those additional knock-on investments that are planned, that are attached into a major capital investment. And that we need to get out of a period of uncertainty, I think, for that to rebalance effectively. But right now, it's very hard to read and understand because it's a very dynamic situation where there's an over and underline on where it makes sense to continue, you know, developing a new product line or making a regional investment. A lot of global supply chains that try to move to a China plus one strategy and ramp up, you know, as an alternative or get their suppliers to relocate in Mexico and Canada, for example, for the North American market, you know, there's no safe haven potentially unless we renegotiate USMCA, et cetera, and kind of we're sort of right on the fine line of are we going to protect material content values up to 70%, 80%, you know, tariff free again? What's the impact? Can we extend that out a little bit further? There's really competing narratives there. And I think that's what's really frustrating for large global manufacturers that have had to, you know, de-risk their global supply chain networks, thought they were making the right appropriate decisions, and now that's not really clear. And so it's not really feasible to nearshore or reshore all that manufacturing capacity, not just to the US, but anywhere the end market demand is that they're trying to serve. So that's a sticky situation. It's complicated, it's layered, and we're going to have to sort of, but I think there'll be a better read on that in about 3 to 6 months. I think right now making any, you know, specific forecast decision, et cetera, is too risky, too uncertain.
So one of the things that I think is a little more certain, but there's still a lot of confusion there, is the CHIPS Act and how the CHIPS Act played out in the U.S. manufacturing sector. I know many of the folks that invest in a wide range of our industrial listings and our land holdings. We're also investors in a number of companies that have benefited greatly from the CHIPS Act. And I'm just kind of curious how you're seeing the CHIPS Act play out from a larger economic structural perspective and kind of what American manufacturing and chip adjacent manufacturing companies can kind of perceive going forward?
Well, I think the CHIPS Act, you know, generally we would view as being well designed because it was trying to be somewhat holistic from an industrial policy perspective, but provide, you know, incentives for new manufacturing investments into the United States, new fab foundry investments, but also looking at, you know, the need for supporting talent, you know, the sort of, you know, sort of nearby, you know, partnerships with universities and others, because that's a key constraint to the build out of the specialized skills that's needed to support, operate, and then around the ecosystem of these new foundries. There's sort of an ecosystem in those locations that kind of create the need for, you know, value added and sort of a newly trained workforce, you know, capabilities. But you also saw a focus on investment in startups and innovation related to semiconductor and, you know, now sort of more tied in software and semiconductor design with AI design chips from NVIDIA, et cetera. That's a pattern that's occurring kind of around that area. But the CHIPS Act also provided incentives for both non-US headquartered, you know, large players like Samsung, for example, and TSMC to take advantage of those incentives for, you know, building out their fab capabilities in the United States, as well as, you know, US champions in a way like Intel. But you know, if you look at Intel, they've been struggling to, you know, find, you know, their path forward, you know, because part of theirs, you know, is the sort of IP intensive chip design, and part of it's a more of a foundry business, and similar to what Global Foundries has been, you know, doing as a fabless semiconductor, you know, TSMC and others. And I think that's right, because the level of capital investment that's required in any fab foundry development is so high. There's only five or six global players in the world that can actually make those investments. So it was going in the right direction. I think we saw a little bit of a reset on the timing on how fast they were going to, you know, we had to move out of a couple years on sort of the end state on these capital projects. But the sort of grant funding and the sort of the investments, you know, getting new ground opened up and underway. We've seen that in almost every major commitment that was committed in the CHIPS Act. What we're seeing now, though, is something that we've seen the current administration both revisit and challenge the CHIPS Act in some way, but it's unclear what the specific concerns were there. And now, because of the sort of extent of the tariff regime, it's again changing the sort of, you know, view of what the full cost and success and the in-market demand kind of patterns are going to look like for any of those new large foundry investments. Because in the semiconductor value chain, what's interesting is that while you may have a fab that's producing chips, the OSAT or the, you know, test and packaging may go to Malaysia and then come back into a final assembly or a tier one supplier and then come back in the United States, you know, in terms of, you know, an automotive, you know, end product. So it's still globalized, even though you have this intensive fab part of that value chain. The flow of those chips and those electronic components is still highly global. So I think it anchored it supported flexibility and resilience in the overall global semiconductor supply chain, because there's just inherent risk with concentration of supply and foundries in certain geographic locations, you know, particularly in Taiwan and Taipei. You know, there's a, you know, 90% of global, you know, semiconductor sort of, you know, advanced, you know, semiconductor chip, you know, core fab production, particularly with TSMC, is occurring in Taiwan. And so there's a broad general need. It's just everyone benefits from diversification, right? So I think the CHIPS Act moved us in the right direction. The question will be, do the near-term tariff impacts slow down or reverse course that direction where that was headed? My view is, you know, we'll see a general need to want to protect those investments and sort of that will continue forward, but maybe there's an additional kind of delay factor as we rebalance and resettle on, you know, plans and have more certainty around that kind of cost side of the equation. you know, to see if that, you know, sort of the, all the related investments. So like Samsung's new foundry in Tyler, Texas here, you know, there's a huge amount of, you know, investment that's happening from infrastructure, logistics, you know, service providers, new, you know, suppliers going up all in that, you know, huge industrial kind of industrial park that they're developing. And, you know, everything looks like it's still on course. But, you know, there could be slowdowns, and even a 1 year delay in their planning has a massive ripple effect on hundreds, if not thousands, of other investments that are tied to that overall production schedule. And that's the thing that I think we had to watch very carefully.
So one of the things that I know everyone's watching carefully, be they, you know, real estate or industrial investors, is potential bottlenecks. And I've been very concerned in talking with a number of people that we do business with on a broader real estate sense in Southern California and the Port of LA that are concerned with the number of ships currently moving out of China. And then we have a lot of concerns with other bottlenecks that are occurring in Mexico and some of the some of the logistics networks that come out of Canada as well into Ontario, into Michigan. And so I'm curious, what are you seeing in terms of potential risks that are occurring at some of these bottlenecks where we've seen trade halt, and how it might affect other areas of the system?
Yeah, you see, whenever you have a shock to the system, again, we saw the pandemic, and we've seen it sort of, kind of by new policy changes that are so, of high impact. I mean, you know, over 100%, 143% tariffs on China. Even if that's in the near term negotiation, active negotiation phase, logistics networks are highly efficient, but they're very sort of leaned out to some degree, as we talked about. Very true in automotive, but across every kind of consumer market, you're not holding lots of 2-3 months worth of inventory in warehouses anymore. There's a lot of fast moving consumer goods patterns. So it is no surprise that we're seeing crazy whipsaw effects of, you know, forward inbound, you know, whether it's air or, you know, ocean, sort of trying to hit, accelerated shipments coming into the United States. I think Apple reported that they shipped 1.6 million units on air from China into the United States. And now we're seeing a huge amount of inbound shipments from India, for example, just for the iPhones, in the near term. That's going to create massive ripple effects and inefficiencies, both on container and transport ship capacity, because if you don't have enough balanced trade going from port to port, you get these, massive imbalances. And that will change both, very quickly spot rates for ocean cargo lanes, et cetera. All of that's getting massively recalculated. There's nothing that looks like it did, 4 or 5 months ago. And that has a huge impact into, particularly Port of LA because of all the trans-Pacific trade. In Mexico, you have a similar disruption, but it's a little bit more concentrated around automotive. Both managing kind of a regional port to port shipment that's kind of on both sides of Pacific and the kind of the, Atlantic to Pacific, to the Gulf, sort of routes, but a lot of multi, intermodal, like sort of train to truck, routes in. Similar thing, high congestion at customs at every, clearance, every port, but I think what we'll see is a ramp down because we're uncertain about, how to front load a lot of manufacturing plants and final assembly plants based on uncertainty around the end product cost demand. It's going to have a ripple effect on all the tier one, tier two suppliers, particularly in automotive, where you see that that really, really tight alignment to an end product and, one OEM's final assembly plant schedule. And that could be binary. I mean, that could be a resetting of overall allocation of vehicle volume production that won't, recover for other suppliers, and hence the utilization of some of those, transportation modes and methods and those small specialized logistics providers, where they're doing, intermodal, or they're attached to a specific you know, port of operation, you know, there could be a massive reset on their business, you know, and they might have to pivot and kind of diversify away. All that adjustment takes months, and there will be winners and losers. I think in Mexico, though, there was already some transportation lane capacity constraints because of the build out and the need to kind of continue to drive and invest and facilitate, you know, faster, more efficient train to highway mode, you know, sort of lanes that were going up and down, you know, 4 or 5 major manufacturing hubs in Mexico. That might alleviate some of that near-term balance, so maybe it's a little bit more efficient. But again, this is not an incremental market movement. We're seeing industries, and you know, particularly in automotive and in high tech in Mexico, having to completely rethink about their total capacity allocation or what they're actually going to produce for, you know, by product line, maybe for months, if not, you know, permanently. And that is really hard to absorb.
Yeah. So in terms of that, one of the biggest things that we've seen happen in the market is we've seen a number of our clients look at potentially onshoring additional storage and developing additional redundancy. Just the week after Trump got reelected, you saw, particularly from some of the raw material suppliers and issues like timber and some of the more resilient suppliers, they looked at going and trying to develop redundancies. And I'm curious if you're seeing that. We've seen it in both, you know, iOS, industrial outdoor storage, as well as seeing it in just cheap redundancy. Are you seeing that play out in markets, or are you seeing just generally people just still in shock at this point?
No, I think we were already seeing a kind of a shift to, you know, redundancies, right? So if you're, you know, when you're talking about outdoor storage, you know, for bulk product, right, that could be timber, but it could be for, you know, bulk metals, you know, finished aluminum, steel, et cetera, you know, that's kind of a, you know, an opportunity because it's so cost intensive to hold and store, you know, those bulk items, you know, that you kind of need to think about, you know, co-locating to where, you know, your consumption areas are versus maybe centralization. So there's a lot of supply chain network design that was happening already that was underway. I think what you're seeing right now is that redundancy, if you will, in terms of more flexible manufacturing locations and also understanding where you might have more optionality for short-term warehouse capacity for fulfillment, just to kind of balance forward buying of inventory way ahead of normal demand patterns, where I might want to hold strategic inventory for 6 months to a year, and it's not aligned to my, you know, my manufacturing or warehouse capacity. So I've got to find that through a partner. I do think that there's a lot of, you know, there's a spot buy market, if you will, for, you know, sort of near-term inventory balancing, et cetera. I think in manufacturing, what you're seeing and was already underway, but will accelerate, that doesn't kind of get the headline news, is more of the specialized manufacturers. You know, you've got 5,000 U.S. manufacturers that are doing additive manufacturing. It could be 3D printing or specialized, you know, CNC, you know, tooling or cutting operations that are, you know, used in multiple different kinds of industry ecosystems, where they might be short run, you know, rather than like sort of, you know, dedicated mainline investments. And that market and that marketplace is really beginning to scale and grow. And, you know, the profile for those manufacturers may be that they're, you know, 5 to 20 million in revenue, but they're specialized and they're able to serve multiple end markets. That's interesting to see that already here kind of investment scaling, because it addresses the needs of many different, you know, manufacturers that are now trying to scramble to nearshore more, let's say, and do it more efficiently without investing in scaling in, you know, direct their own manufacturing capacity or asking their major tier one suppliers. So that's an interesting profile to look at from a growth perspective, and to see which of those specialized manufacturers, you know, they're not your largest global you know, players, but they're feeding into this new demand opportunity, and they have more flexibility maybe to stand up new lines or accept new tooling operations, et cetera, and meet those needs. that'll be a vibrant near-term area. I think that'll continue to scale and grow. But we're going to see this, like, you know, the issue is how much of this yard storage or, you know, expanded, you know, flex warehouse capacity, et cetera, is sustainable based on, their market forecasts or, you know, their sort of, 6 to 9 month, you know, annual views on utilization for long-term contracts versus more spot buy arrangements. I think that'll be the mix, is to see, you know, how things can rebalance for certainty and you can kind of, you know, commit, usage and allocation. And that means that uncertainty is really hard for everyone, because if you're not sure about your allocation and utilization, it's very hard to price the market.
I know we're all in this period of uncertainty right now. One of the things that I know a lot of people are looking for is more certainty. I know with your business, you've worked on commodity IQ and trying to understand places where there's potential distress. Where are the best places for folks to reach out to you at Commodity IQ and kind of understand where potential distress could come with tenants?
Well, thank you for that. I think that, we developed Commodity IQ during the pandemic because we were watching things happen in real time, not just across electronics, but other key commodity markets. You know, we added specialty metals, you know, we're sort of looking at a kind of a combination of different over 400 different commodity categories. But what we realized is if we can triangulate and provide more market intelligence as both understanding what's happening, both kind of at a geographic, but also in a commodity aggregated level, and then combine in particular forward-looking demand signals, like where are new, not just short-term purchases and sort of dynamics around lead time and cost occurring, but what's the long-term demand drivers, particularly around engineered products, so that everyone can have a kind of a balanced near-term and short-term, you know, longer-term view. And then we started developing kind of a six-month outlook where, you know, we have the right, you know, data volume density to kind of predict this is where we're seeing price, lead time, cost, and inventory, moving in those areas. That kind of third-party market intelligence, I think, is incredibly critical at a time like this when we have a lot more uncertainty, because, you know, what we did in the past or what our models, you know, showed that worked for us before is sometimes insufficient. We really need to get external intelligence and make sure that it's close to almost near real time, you know, and that it's not just a periodic quarterly update. It needs to be kind of an ongoing, because these dynamics are playing out in complicated ways and sort of, you know, to triangulate, it's not obvious what's, you know, what the market response is or the timing. So any company interested can, you know, definitely go to supplyframe.com. Learn more about Commodity IQ. It's very easy to, you know, to subscribe and get on board. And we find that, you know, we have customers that use it around, both managing their, you know, direct materials procurement, but also in terms of their product positioning and placements, and then understanding supply chain, multi-tier supply chain trends that they're helping them think about their sources of supply and how they're building out their supply chain networks. And all of that, you know, becomes incredibly valuable if you're focused on a specific sector or, you know, in a different geography to understand the context of everything that might be happening around those big anchor investments.
So, you know, when we're making big investments, sometimes it can be years down the road. And one of the things we like to do is we do this final four, where we talk, it's four quick questions, and it kind of gives us a roundup of kind of what we can expect going forward and kind of how we can adjust and change in our lives to be better real estate investors and just better human beings in general. So one of the things that, you know, when we're talking about forecasting is kind of forecasting trade patterns generally. Where do you see trade, you know, 5 and 10 years out? Are we going to stay in this crazy world forever, or are things going to mellow out, and are we going to have a little more certainty?
We'll have more certainty for sure. I think we will, you know, the markets and, you know, the dynamics around trading partner, you know, sort of, you know, realignment, let's say, will play out. I think we'll, you know, 4 to 5 years, we should be in a better place, certainly, but we may be seeing the world might look very different than today in terms of where there's a higher concentration of investment, and where, you know, there's more, at least, regionalization and more flexibility in global supply chains. I don't firmly believe in the full decoupling view, particularly with just China. I think there's going to be a lot of rebalancing and diversification that's going to be healthy for the market overall. But it's not going to look like it does today.
And one of the other things that we love is not just talking about today, but kind of taking a step back. And there's a lot of people that listen to the podcast that are earlier on in their careers. And if you had 1 minute of career advice that you could give your younger self, what would it be?
Great question. I think when you're thinking about your energy and your commitment and what, you know, drives you, I think it's really important to be intentional about where you want to invest your time and learning and check in with yourself every 6 months to make sure that those choices and those decisions still resonate. And if there's new information that's come in, adjust and pivot, you know, more quickly. I think sometimes we get caught up in, a story that we tell ourselves about what we want and our ambition, our drive, and what does that look like? And then it doesn't serve us later. And we feel sometimes trapped or overcommitted to something that's not working for us. And I think it's really important to, you know, check in frequently and realign, because our lives and our careers as professionals continues to evolve. And that curiosity and that realignment to our authentic self and what drives us is really important to maintain to be truly successful and to align for success.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In terms of evolving, one of the ways that we like to evolve, not just talking to people and learning by doing, but learning by reading. And so I'm curious if there's a book that our listeners should pick up, particularly something that's, you know, trade or business related.
Well, The Chip Wars is an interesting one to go back and review. It was written during the pandemic, but, you know, it's kind of this topic of electronics, you know, and sort of the semiconductor industry. It does a really good way of describing actually the history and the evolution, particularly of the U.S., semiconductor industry and how it evolved and globalized with a lot of public-private investment, you know, and is actually really interesting to understand kind of the dynamics and the context of what's happening right now, more on a global basis. You know, I find that I've got this Source to Sold book that's an interesting compilation of global supply chain leaders, interviews with them in different industries and, you know, how they've driven innovation. These types of books are interesting to understand. I think in general, if you haven't spent time to kind of understand global supply chains or, you know, what sort of the key imperatives are and strategies that, you know, companies are, you know, global supply chain leaders are looking at, now is the time to get educated about that, because we're all in the sort of the conversation. We're all being impacted by the response to tariffs, the reposition of global supply chains in response to market dynamics, that's affecting all of us. And so we just need to continue to be more educated in that area as well.
So the last question, and I won't let you get away from this one, because this is the whole reason for the podcast. And it's, you know, we firmly believe that the men and women who are in the arena, be it, you know, in trade or commercial real estate or industrial logistics, whatever it is, that they tend to know the next person or at least the right person to talk to. And so I'm very curious, who should the next person be that we bring on that's trade related on the podcast?
That is a great question. I think there's a couple, you know, there's some folks that are in the sort of logistics, you know, ecosystem that are really on the front lines of understanding, you know, what's happening in that final mile dynamics. Adrian Gonzalez is really interesting in that area. And then from a global supply chain perspective, Laura Cesari, who's been an analyst for a long time and a friend, you know, has a great, you know, perspective on the over under on what's happening. And she's got great pattern recognition, you know, 40 years of, you know, analyzing, you know, global supply chains and looking at it. So, there's definitely some great experts in the mix that we can tee up maybe potentially for the next conversation.
Richard, I truly appreciate it. Now, there's one final question, and it's important as well. If somebody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way to get in contact?
They can reach out to me directly on email at rbarnett@supplyframe.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. Happy to connect there if that's easier as well. But definitely go to supplyframe.com's resources site tons of great articles and insights that we publish and share for free. And, you know, would love to connect and continue the conversation if it's helpful.
Richard, thank you so very much. I really appreciate it. And we have to have you on in the future.
Thank you, Gordon. I appreciate it as well. Thank you, sir.
Thanks again to Richard. We really appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a follow, a 5-star review. It really doesn't matter. Your interactions and subscriptions, though, do. And they help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lamphere with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for watching.